This week, we're going to continue on talking about how we go from the biblical manuscripts and their copies to the Bibles on our coffee tables on Unapologetic. Even if you weren't able to listen to last week's episode, this week's episode will still be helpful to you on its own. But I want to quickly recap where we went and what we covered last time. We talked about the fact that there are thousands and thousands of New Testament Greek manuscripts and even thousands more in other languages, and these date very early. And there are enough of these that we can tell that even though there are changes, there are no large changes, there are no substantive changes, there are no changes that depart from essential Christian doctrine. And so while there may be differences in word order or spelling, no difference between manuscripts, between these copies, alters the meaning in a substantial way. And that's important because we can have confidence that we can recreate through a scientific process called textual criticism what the originals most likely said with a high degree of confidence. And so we talked about how we worked through those differences in manuscripts last week. And this week we're going to continue on talking about how do we go from the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament to our English Bibles. Well, let's talk about how this has been done a couple different times throughout history. One of the early English translations was the King James Bible. And this translation was made from about six Greek manuscripts. So there were six manuscripts of the Greek New Testament that were used in the translation of the King James English translation. But these six manuscripts don't agree in all places. And more than that, these six manuscripts come from a larger group of manuscripts called the Byzantine text. And this is a group of manuscripts that were created by the monks at Byzantium. It turns out that while we have Xerox machines today, they had them in the past. They were just called monks. And these monks in Byzantium turned out a large number of manuscripts, by far the largest group of manuscripts that all kind of have the same attributes and characteristics came from these monks in Byzantium. But remember, like we talked about last week, just because something exists in a larger quantity, just because there are more copies that agree, that doesn't mean that whatever the specific reading is more accurate. But from this very large group of manuscripts, six were chosen, and that is what drove the translation of the King James Bible. But most of these manuscripts came from the 12th century. Now, let's refresh ourselves briefly. The New Testament was written in the first century. A lot of the copies that are very close to the originals are from the first, second, and third century. And yet the ones for the KJV are from the 12th. That's very far removed. And this speaks to why there are several decently sized differences between the KJV and other translations. The KJV has verses, whole verses, that are not in other translations. Not because later and more modern translations have removed the verses, but because they should have never been in the KJV to start with, because the manuscripts that they worked from were very far removed from the originals. Now, for its time, it was excellent. I mean, it's remarkable what people did so early on without the wealth of information and scholarly insight we have today. And I don't want to come across as saying that we're somehow much more better and enlightened and educated than the people who worked several centuries ago. But in some ways, it is true that we have a deeper depth of insight to work with, and there's more archaeological evidence and language evidence that allows us to create better translations. But in the same way that the translators of the KJV went to Greek manuscripts to make their translation, today we do the same thing. Okay, so we don't necessarily go to those same manuscripts, but what we do is we choose the manuscripts that have the best readings at different places, and we assemble those into what's called a critical text. And this is a text that isn't existing anywhere out there in the world. There's not a manuscript that contains this text, quote unquote. But what it is we look at the differences between manuscripts, like we talked about last week, the variants, that's kind of the technical term, the places where these differ between each other. And we say, this one has the best evidence for this reading of this part of this verse, and this one has the best evidence for this part of this verse. And we take all of those and we assemble them into a text. that best represents the originals based on this scientific process of textual criticism. And from this text, which is representing the oldest and best manuscripts, we translate any new translation. So sometimes you'll hear that the Bible is a translation of a translation of a translation of a translation. That's simply not true. That sounds really good if you're an atheist or some other religion or cult and you toss that out, but it's simply false. So for instance, when the New English Translation came out in the last decade or so, that wasn't somehow a translation of the NIV before that, which wasn't a translation of the RSV before that, which wasn't a translation of the KJV. At each point, scholars go back to the oldest and best manuscripts at that time, and they're going from one language, Greek, to one other language, English. There's no intermediate step. There's not a translation of a translation of a translation. And so, because this is how the process works, we can address some of those claims we talked about at the very beginning of last week's episode. Some people will say that the Bible has been changed over time to make it seem like that there's a male and a female complementarity, and that these are not equal in every way, that man and woman are different, equal in intrinsic worth and dignity, but they're distinct, and they have complementary yet different roles. People say that type of thing has been added. But when you realize that we always go back to the oldest and best manuscripts, that we have that data, there is no evidence for that claim. In fact, all of the evidence contradicts that claim. When the Muslim says that the Bible has been corrupted over time and that we can't trust it, well, the fact is that when the Quran was written in the 7th century, that we have manuscripts from that century and the century before and the century before that. And we can compare that to the earlier manuscripts and the way we translate it today and show there's been no change. So if you simply look at the evidence and you can get a Muslim to look at the evidence, you can show them that when Muhammad affirmed the gospel, that it's the same gospel we have today, that we can show you that what the gospel was in the 7th century, how it was written, what the manuscripts were, that matches how we translate it today. That matches what we have from the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries. So there's been no change. The evidence is there to show and debunk that claim. In the same way with the Mormon, who will say, well, yes, I affirm that the Bible is scripture in as much as it has been translated correctly. What they actually don't mean is translated. They mean transmitted. And this is actually a very important point that we'll have to spend time on another day. But if it's translated or transmitted, either one of those, well, show me where it hasn't been translated correctly or transmitted correctly. They can't do that. You can ask, which parts of the Bible don't you read since they've been translated incorrectly? Well, they can't tell you that often either. And the point is we can look all the way back through the centuries and show there has been no change. There's been no deviation in what the Bible says from the originals. And that is an incredibly important point. So we've now established how we create what's called a critical text. We take the best readings. Variants are evaluated on a case-by-case basis. But still, how do we go to the English? Well, there are two ways to translate any language. There is a formally equivalent type of translation and a dynamic equivalent type of translation. A formal equivalent translation is what you might expect for formal. It's a word for word. So if there were 10 words in the original, then we're going to try and have 10 words in the target language. So if you're going from Greek to English, the target language is English. The source language is Greek. It's kind of like if you had Spanish as a foreign language. You sometimes would translate from English to Spanish and Spanish to English. Well, what you probably realized in that process is that sometimes a word-for-word translation, a formal equivalent translation, has some strengths and it has some weaknesses. If you translate from English the phrase, "Does the cat have your tongue?" into Spanish, it's not going to translate well. The words will translate, but the meaning is lost. And that's because sometimes idioms and other phrases, while a word-for-word translation conveys the original words, it doesn't convey the meaning. And so that's an important distinction. Sometimes, and oftentimes, a formally equivalent translation leaves interpretation to the often uninformed reader. And by uninformed, I mean that we're not necessarily in tune to the original context and idiom and culture that these texts and their languages were written in. And so a formally equivalent translation leaves more work to the reader. Now, so what are examples of a formally equivalent translation? The KJV is pretty formally equivalent. The New American Standard Bible is fairly formally equivalent. The ESV is formally equivalent also. And just like many things, formal and dynamic equivalence exists on a spectrum. It's not argue one or argue the other, but how much of one are you? Okay, so some translations are more formally equivalent than another. And like I said, on the other end of the spectrum is dynamic equivalence. And this is a phrase-for-phrase translation. It's really a translation based on meaning. So let's say in the original Greek, a literal translation, a word-for-word translation, formally equivalent, would be God's nostrils enlarged. That is what those words said in Greek, literally. Well, you could translate that into English as God's nostrils enlarged, or you could translate it as God became angry, because that was what was meant by it. Well, the more helpful translation, at least in this case, is God became angry, because God doesn't have nostrils. And of course, there are anthropomorphic language, language about God that kind of conveys attributes of him in human terms, even though he's not human. But a better translation that's going to communicate most effectively to the average person today is God became angry. There are several dynamically equivalent translations. The NIV is certainly dynamically equivalent. The New English Translation is somewhere in between formal and dynamic. Now, sometimes dynamic equivalent translations get a bad rap today. They get a bad reputation. And I'm not sure how deserved that is. And let me explain. Most of the time, when your New Testament author is quoting the Old Testament, they're not quoting the Hebrew. Or at least a lot of the time, this is the case. They're quoting the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. They're quoting a translation. And most of the Greek translations of the Old Testament were dynamically equivalent. Isn't that interesting? That for Paul, he was comfortable using a dynamic equivalent translation of the Old Testament, but many people today are not comfortable using a dynamic equivalent translation of the New Testament. I think there's a point there to consider, that translating based on meaning is the best way to translate for the average person, for people like you and for people like me. What we really care about is not the original necessarily words verbatim, but what those words mean. After all, it's not just that there are letters and groupings of letters that are important, but it's the meaning that is conveyed by those that is what is important. Obviously, the meaning is conveyed through the vehicle of words and sentences, and so I'm not saying words and sentences are not important. But ultimately, the gospel is the power of salvation, and that is communicated through meaning. The gospel is meaning that is communicated through words, so words are a vehicle. It is the meanings that are important. And so using a dynamically equivalent translation can be very helpful. Now, you do need to realize, though, that your starting position in reading the Bible is the ending position for someone else's work. You have received the product of a lot of work. There's a lot of work that goes into these translation decisions of what do these original words mean if we're going to translate based on meaning. And even a formally equivalent translation has these types of concerns. You are receiving the product of someone else's work that you are only then beginning to use for your studies. And so you need to know the types of decisions that were made for you. How does your Bible translate, for instance, Paul's use of the word flesh in Greek, which is sarx, in your translation? Does it leave it as flesh and potentially confuse someone to where they might think that in Romans 8, someone who's in their skin and bones flesh can't please God? Or does your translation translate it sinful nature? Well, there are some theological ramifications from that. There are decisions that have been made for you. Sometimes those are right decisions, unequivocally. No questions asked. Sometimes there are more questions about if the right translation was made. But you need to realize that some of those decisions have been made for you, depending on the translation you use. Oftentimes, the preface or the translator's website will tell you about some of the ways they've approached the translation. You need to know those types of things. It's kind of like if you're going to go dig around in your yard, you need to know where the gas line is and the electrical lines are so you don't hit those, so you can work around them, so you can even maybe tap into them if you need to run an extension off of it. It's the same way with translations. You need to know the decisions that have been made before you. You need to know the landscape so you can more effectively use that translation. But really, the easiest way to get the most bang for your buck out of a Bible translation is not to use one, but to use two. Choose a formally equivalent translation and a dynamically equivalent translation and read both. Read them side by side when you want to better understand the text. So choose something like the ESV and choose something like the NIV and read a passage in both. And simply by seeing how two different groups of people translated the same verse, you will almost instantly understand better the depth of meaning of that verse. Sometimes this is simply because different translations are going to use synonyms for the same word to translate. And now you get a better idea of the actual usage of the word in that case. For sometimes, a translation, like I said, may use flesh, another may use sinful nature. Well, the fact that you can see both of those side by side gives you a better indication of what's being talked about there. It's the same way with other terms like righteousness and justification and those types of things. When we see synonyms, it gives us a broader and yet still deeper idea of what's being talked about. So, to recap, we can have great confidence in what the original manuscript said and the fact that that's reflected in the manuscripts copies we have today. And more than that, that the English translations we have today are not translations of translations of translations. They go back to the earliest and best manuscripts all the time whenever a new translation is made. We make new translations because language changes. We need to always be communicating the meaning of the originals in the currently understandable way of our day and the language as it's spoken and understood. That's why we have new translations. And more than that, that there are different ways to translate. There is a formally equivalent way and a dynamically equivalent way. And I think there's a lot of merit in the dynamically equivalent way, but there are liabilities with it too, because decisions are being made for you before you get the text and work with it. So use both. Well, I hope this series has been helpful. In the future, we'll also talk about, do we have the right books in our Bible? How did we end up with those? Did that come down by fiat? Is that book list inspired too? And all of those types of questions. But I hope you'll join me next week for Unapologetic.